You're listening to Well Now, Slate's podcast on health and wellness. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. Kavita, have you ever looked closely at your medical bill? Maybe one of those statements from your health insurance company? It is incredibly confusing and shocking. And when you owe money, it's unclear how much and for what reason. And quite often, it's more than what you expected. So the explanation of benefits, that's what I believe it's called, is this very lengthy, coded kind of thing that shows up. And then when you get through it, you feel like you've got even more questions than you had before the procedure or visit even happened.
Oh, Maya, you're singing my siren song. I have been spending literally decades trying to, shockingly, work on making that EOB, Explanation of Benefits statement, simpler. It may shock you to believe that before 2010, it was even more complicated. It's sad that what we have today is simpler. But I have always been amazed at a couple of things, Maya. One, it's one of the few industries where you're guaranteed to only get this in paper and weeks after the service.
I know. What is up with the weeks after the service? I'm like, can't you just give it to me at the time of service?
Correct. Weeks after the service, one of the few where you have to wait weeks and hope that you get the right mail and hope you wait in the mailbox. Then when you look at it, it's very unclear. Patient responsibility. What did your insurance company negotiate? What did the doctor or hospital or office charge? And then you start to see all these other fees in there. And I do think that it's just unbelievable how even people like yourself, myself, highly educated, part of the healthcare system, it literally looks like I'm reading Latin. I mean, like I could not tell you or explain to someone else what that is. But what's your experience?
So my insurance is overseas because I'm married to someone who has citizenship somewhere else.
But they are responsible for paying for medical services in the domestic United States, correct?
Yes, worldwide. So it's great health insurance. With that said, it's interesting because for years, we've operated as self-pay individuals because we pay up front and then we're reimbursed by our insurance. So we've always seen everything. And I ask for the ICD-10 codes. So it is the codes that define whatever disease or procedure has been done any given day at any given time with the provider that I'm seeing. And I need everything clear and written out. And you should see every time I ask, nobody knows what to give me. And Kavita, it is weeks, if not months, before I receive a bill. And then there are adjustments because they're treating me like a self-pay patient, even though I'm not a self-pay patient. And so then I call back and I say, you've put a whole bunch of adjustments in here. I want to make sure that you intended to put these adjustments in and that this is, in fact, the number that you want me to pay. I go ahead, I pay it, I submit it to my insurance. Kavita, I get another bill. Sorry, we made a mistake. The bill that we sent you wasn't correct. There is, in fact, an outstanding charge. This is for physicals, mammograms, PAP, you name it, for my kids' appointments. And we've had the same insurance for the last 26 years. And we see the same providers for the last 26 years. But it is like the system is so upside down that they don't even know what to do with us or how to get us a bill that is a definitive, finite amount that we can pay and close it. So it's constant. I just have always these open bills that are in discussion or negotiation. And that's kind of how I live. The upside is, Kavita, anyone with an MD, I can see them. And how about you, Kavita?
Well, you're very, I would say, both blessed and maybe cursed, if I can be honest.
Yes. Blessing and a curse.
I do think that yours is a slightly atypical experience in some regards. Having the ability to see any MD is definitely atypical. And mine is probably a little more typical because I have kind of what I would say is the majority of the country standard employer-based insurance because of my work. And it is a very basic plan. I have a high deductible health plan, which means that it's a little cheaper to pay for my health care because I will take on personally the responsibility of the first $10,000 in costs. I will just tell you that the only reason I do that is because I pair it with something called a health savings account. Mm-hmm. Long story short, I have made choices where I know I'll pay more upfront in order to kind of save more later, but that's an area of privilege, I'll say. So but what stands out the most for me is that with the birth of my first child, my son, I remember kind of looking through pages and pages of the bill because I had worked on this issue in policy and I was just curious. And I had seen that there was initially the little box of how much you owe the hospital initially had thousands of dollars for the I owe this many dollars. And it was before I have the plan I have now. So I should not have paid that much. I knew that. I knew enough about healthcare. I looked, found out that my anesthesiologist, whom I did not choose, to be clear, I went to an hospital that was in network. I went to an OBGYN that was in network. I did all the things an expert healthcare consumer could and should do. And they had the anesthesiologist on call that was not someone I knew, and nor could I pick. And that individual was hired by a group that was not in network with my insurance company. So the bill I got was about 180% higher than one would expect. And I had a larger proportion of that was out of pocket that I had to pay. So I would say, like one in five Americans who get one of these surprise medical bills. And I think it's just, this is the world we're in, Maya. I hesitate to say this, but someone of our health literacy, our experience, and I dare to say it, our Rolodex, right? You and I know people. If you go to Cornell and I go to Hopkins and something happens and we get something funny in the mail, I know people I can call in senior leadership there, people in charge of their billing, and I can say, hey, this doesn't look right. Can you help me? And I will get action. 99.999% of people do not have that luxury. So I do think we're tackling a really important issue. And it's why this week we really wanted to speak to, I would say, one of America's most trusted squeaky wheels, someone who's a very close friend of mine, privileged to call him a friend, and was a former Surgeon General. And he's going to talk about the fact that he too was affected by what you and I are just describing, the confusion, the surprise bill, and the fear that comes from what happens if I can't pay this bill. What are the effects? Stay tuned.
Hey Well Now listeners, if you're enjoying the show and want to hear more, subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Wednesday morning. While you're there, check out our other episodes too, like last week's about navigating wellness and mental illness with writer and podcaster Allison Raskin. Check it out.
Welcome back. You're listening to Well Now. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. So today we're going to talk about surprise medical bills. So many of us have had them. And we're going to talk about more with America's doctor, former Surgeon General Jerome Adams. He served for the Trump administration from 2017 to 2021. He recently published a book, Crisis and Chaos, Lessons from the Front Lines of the War Against COVID-19. Now, Dr. Adams is a distinguished professor and director of health equity initiatives at Purdue University and a practicing anesthesiologist. Jerome, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And as you mentioned, still practicing physician, was in the operating room taking care of patients yesterday, and I hope none of them get a surprise medical bill from my care.
I hope so, too. So before we get to the meat or the heart of our conversation, we want to ask you this question that we always ask everyone. And I'm very interested in hearing your answer. Jerome, how do you define wellness?
I define wellness really in the same way that I think about health equity. Wellness is going to be something that is different for every person. And really, my goal as director of health equity at Purdue is making sure everyone has a fair opportunity to be their healthiest self, mentally, spiritually, physically. So for some people, that may mean being able to run a marathon. For other people, it may just mean being able to get up and walk to the mailbox. That may be their definition of wellness. Wellness is really just helping people understand their potential and be able to reach it.
Mm-hmm. That resonates. I love that. Understand your potential and being able to reach it.
Yeah, it's a great, it's succinct, which is why it resonates, I think. All right, Jerome, I love your website. You start describing yourself probably in what the role I would say that is your proudest. You're a dad and a doctor and the former Surgeon General, but you did have a recent title added that I notice is not necessarily on your website, but I think is really important. Patient with a surprise medical bill, or definitely a shocking medical bill. And it turns out you're not in rare company, but can you tell us more about that? Jerome, what's sad is that it shouldn't be this way in 2024, and yet here we are. But tell us your story.
You're right. It shouldn't be this way. And I'll walk you through. A couple of months ago in January, I went to Arizona for a conference. And while I was there, I decided to go hike up Camelback Mountain, like many people do. Hiked up the mountain, had a bottle of water with me, came back down, felt fine. Literally, I went back to my hotel room, took a shower, then met some colleagues out for dinner. And while I was at dinner, I started to feel lightheaded and got dizzy. And I'm surrounded by medical colleagues. I was at the Society of Critical Care Medicine annual meeting, coincidentally. And they all say, you should go to the hospital and get checked out. And I say, and everyone agrees, this is probably just dehydration, dry air, being on a plane, hiking up a mountain, but better to go get it checked out, which is what we as physicians would tell a patient. You know, out of an abundance of caution, go get it checked out. First of all, they call an ambulance because no one wants me to drive and we're out of town. So we get an ambulance and they give me fluids in the ambulance. And by the time I'm at the emergency room, I'm actually feeling great. And so we say, okay, let's do some basic labs, confirm the diagnosis. They do that, give me a couple more bags of IV fluids, and in a couple of hours, we're pretty darn sure the diagnosis is dehydration. And so we have a question about whether or not they should send me home. And I have this conversation with my emergency room doctors, and again, we decide out of an abundance of caution, let's just watch you overnight. So I leave the next morning at about 7 a.m. They didn't do anything more to me overnight. Fast forward about 4 to 6 weeks, I get a bill that says I owe Mayo Clinic $4,800. And I look at this bill, and I'm a medical professional, so I start to try to dissect it. I reach back out and ask them if they can send me an itemized bill. That takes several weeks to come back again. Meanwhile, I'm stressed out about this $4,800 bill. And they send me an itemized bill, and I see that they charged me 11 times the market rate for a CMP, a comprehensive metabolic panel, which for those who aren't aware is a basic lab test. I see that they gave me some IV fluids, and I see that for all that, they actually charged me, billed me $10,000, and my insurance negotiated it down to $4,800 that I owe because I have a high deductible health plan, and it was January, and I hadn't paid into my HSA yet. So that's a synopsis of the story. And we can dig into the different parts, but coverage, high deductible health plans was a part of this story. Lack of transparency was a part of this story. If at any point they told me, we're going to send you a bill for $10,000, I would have said, I'm going to go home and drink some Gatorade. The lack of ability to arbitrate is part of this story. I'm still going back and forth with Mayo Clinic, and essentially they've told me, hey, this is what we charge. You either pay it or we send you to collections. That's the point I'm at as a former Surgeon General. And all this, I guess I would summarize by saying, I'm the former United States Surgeon General. I'm a practicing physician. If this is what I'm dealing with, the average consumer does not stand a chance. And that is why I talked about it, why I publicized it, why I spoke about it in the media. And I've been shocked at how much every single time I talk about it, I get hundreds of people replying saying, oh my gosh, here's my bill. Here's what I got charged. This is what happened to me. And it's why medical debt is the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States.
Jerome, I could not agree more. And it's something that I hear among my close circle of friends. I hear it in my work as a dietitian with my patients saying, this is covered, but not. And I think I need a prior authorization. So like, I think you need to call in and see if this will be covered. However, I'm not sure if it will be covered. And it's all up in this kind of bubble of, well, we just don't know. And as you said, Jerome, about 66% of all bankruptcies are due to medical costs. I mean, this is astounding. How does that happen? And what rights do patients themselves have?
Well, that's a lot of the debate that we're having right now on a federal and a state level is what rights should patients have? and who was actually responsible for this. What's also been fascinating, and I'm talking to you and Kavita, who are healthcare professionals, is the finger pointing that's gone on. People say, no, it's the doctor's fault. No, it's the insurance company's fault. No, it's the federal government's fault for setting up this system, and on and on and on. And really, I think most of all, we should, number one, have transparency. We like to tell ourselves that we value capitalism and marketplaces in the United States, and that healthcare should operate like a marketplace. But there's no other marketplace where you go in and you try to purchase a product and they tell you, we'll tell you the cost of it 6 weeks from now, after it's too late for you to say, I don't want this service or this product anymore. And there's no other marketplace where if you don't get what you were expecting, where you literally have no recourse whatsoever. So transparency, I think, is key for the functioning of a marketplace. I also would point out that we're the only developed nation in the world that hasn't figured out how to give a baseline level of health care to all of our citizens without them feeling like they're going to be bankrupted by receiving that care. And that creates problems because in Mayo Clinic's defense, they're cost shifting. They're looking at me and saying, oh, you can pay this much, so we're going to charge you $10,000 to make up for the 9 other people who are going to come in tonight who aren't going to pay or who don't have insurance. And that's not fair to me. It's not fair to the system. And it creates all these weird, perverse incentives that cause people to act in ways that no other nation sees occurring.
Yeah, it's not only distorted incentives, but it feels like even if you can peel back one layer, for example, like not having these things go to collection, you're not really solving the root problem. And so there was a little blip of hope in 2022 when Congress passed the No Surprises Act. It's referred to as the NSA. Most people know the NSA is something else, but in policy world, NSA, No Surprises Act, as well as some other kind of transparency-oriented regulations, you know, trying to get hospitals to put their pricing out there, have it be more publicly available to patients. But the whole goal was to do something that you've talked about for years and still feel is necessary, because 18% of emergency room visits result in at least one surprise medical bill. That's a lot of people, including you. So this law, NSA, was supposed to create a more even playing field and allow patients to avoid receiving these bills. Just, you said you had a little more to your story. Do you mind telling us what happened when you tried to challenge your bill? So you theoretically, even though you were in network probably, have some rights. But what happened when you did interact with the health system and say, hey, this is not right? What happened?
I did what I recommend every patient does, and that's ask questions. It took them weeks to send me the itemized bill. I saw the itemized bill and I asked them questions about several parts of the itemized bill, including the coding, the level of care, what they charged me. And it took, again, several weeks for them to get back to me. And what you have to understand is the average consumer, they're sitting there scared that they're going to get sent to collections. It's going to mess up their credit. They're not going to be able to get their car loan or their house loan while all this is going on. And they get back to me and say, hey, yeah, we know we charged you way more than what these services would typically cost if you were to get them a la carte on the market. But this is the system that we exist in, and this is what we charge everybody. So this is what we're going to charge you. I haven't had a happy ending, but in many cases, you hear people when you reach out, when you ask questions, you either find mistakes or they will negotiate down your payment. I'll be honest here with you all. I think one of the reasons they're reticent to negotiate with me is likely because I'm the former Surgeon General. And because, honestly, I think it's actually hurting me. And I think they're in a situation now where they're scared that if they actually give me a concession and it gets publicized, everyone's going to want one. But anyone listening to this, I want you to know that in many cases, when you ask that question, they will either find a mistake or they will negotiate your bill down to something more reasonable.
And maybe you can underscore that point briefly, that if you had actually walked in with no insurance and had to do the cash pay, probably would have had a smaller bill. It's possible. And the irony is that insurance doesn't do what it was set out to do, you know, in the 60s when we started with Medicare and Medicaid and wanted to make sure everyone had access then in the Affordable Care Act.
Well, it's fascinating the perverse cost shifting that goes on. So let's say you go into a hospital and the actual cost for a service is $20. What they will often do is bill you $100 for that service, knowing that almost no one is actually going to end up paying $100 for that service. Then they go to insurance and insurance says, we're only going to give you half of what you billed. And insurance will pay them $50. But now many institutions know, well, they've actually been called out on the fact that if you came in without insurance, what many used to do, and far too many still do, is they just charge the individual $100.
Exactly.
And people started to say, well, why are you charging me $100 when I have no insurance and the people with insurance are getting charged $50? Well, now what many places will do is they'll have a discounted rate if you're not insured. And they'll say, okay, if you're not insured, we'll charge you $40. And so you're in this weird situation where they may actually charge you $40 if you have no insurance. They're charging you $50 if you have insurance. And then, and I don't want to get too complicated here, but this is where high deductible health plans come into play. Because for me, I have a $5,000 deductible. And so I'm responsible for the first $5,000 of my medical bill. And if they charge me $50, charge my insurance $50, I'm responsible for that. So there's a very real chance that I go in and if I tell them I have insurance, I pay $50. If I tell them I don't have insurance, I pay $40.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's mind-boggling, but it's real. And it's helpful to have listeners hear everything at the granular level to give us better, I think, access to care. So let's take a break here. When we come back, we're going to hear more from Dr. Jerome Adams and his thoughts on how to make healthcare more accessible and affordable for all. You're listening to Well Now from Slate. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. We're continuing our conversation with former Surgeon General Jerome Adams about his recent experience as the recipient of a surprise medical bill. Okay, so Jerome, clearly as the former Surgeon General, you had connections that could have helped solve this problem, and you said it yourself. You actually think that it's hindering you, right, in some way, shape, or form. And you could have solved this perhaps without going public. And I'm sure that the hospital you went to wished that you did the same. So why, in your words, is it important to use the platform that you have to highlight this issue?
Well, first of all, I want to say to folks that I am blessed. I'm fortunate in that a $5,000 bill isn't going to prevent me from sending my kids to school or paying my rent or paying my car payment. I'm not arguing with Mayo Clinic here simply because I don't want to pay. As a matter of fact, I said to them, I'm perfectly fine paying a reasonable amount, but I don't think $10,000 for what essentially amounts to $500 worth of services is a reasonable charge for this bill. The reason why I'm lifting this up is because I grew up poor. I grew up a minority. I grew up, like far too many in America, in a situation where this could be the reason that I have to file for bankruptcy, where it could be the difference between me being able to purchase a new home or not, or pay rent, or even put food on the table. And so I wanted to go through this like a regular consumer. I never told anyone who I was until several weeks into it when I was like, I can't believe I'm not getting anywhere here. And I wanted to put it out there on social media so people could see it. And that's really what I try to use my platform to do, is to help people understand they're not alone, to help them understand the real challenges in the system and break down those different challenges in the system, and to hopefully advocate for them. And so, end of the day, whether or not Mayo makes a compromise with me, what I hope is that people understand the system better and that policymakers will see that this is a problem. If I can't navigate the system, then it shows you that the average citizen, the average constituent has little to no hope. And I hope that they'll make some meaningful changes in the system moving forward, including more transparency, including arbitration. And Dr. Patel mentioned the NSA, the No Surprises Act from Congress. I think another part of this that people need to understand is there's only so much you can do in DC. You have your executive branch, There are some things you can do by executive order. You have your legislative branch. Most things have to be done through legislation, particularly when it comes to Medicare and Medicaid. You can't just tell people to do something if the Medicare and Medicaid laws say that you can't. But it's important for people to also know that a lot of the authority and enforcement goes on at the state and local level. And so you have state insurance commissioners who are in charge of looking at the way insurance is adjudicated. I used to run the State Department of Health in Indiana, and I regulated hospitals. So if you have a complaint against the hospital as opposed to the insurance, that is typically a state issue. And so many different players here. And I want people to understand the system so that they can advocate for policies that will help everyone moving forward. And this hurts our country. It hurts our country when 66% of bankruptcies are due to medical debt. It hurts our country when people are scared to go in and get preventative care or to get care early on because they're worried they're going to get hit with one of these bills. And so what happens? They show up with stage 4 cancer. They show up in diabetic ketoacidosis. They show up at a time when it's far too late in many cases for us to intervene, or when that intervention ends up costing the individual and society much more money than if we dealt with it up front. We need more focus on prevention, and we can't have that focus on prevention if people are scared of the bill.
What can people do if they're anxious, worried about their health, and they need to seek care, but they want to avoid what happened to you?
Well, a couple of things that I would say to folks. I would say, number one, don't wait until an emergency to understand what your coverage options are. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, thanks to, in many cases, states that have expanded Medicaid or coverage, there are many opportunities out there now to get coverage. And a lot of times people just don't know. They just don't know until it's too late. They don't ask until it's too late. And so, number one, understand your coverage options. Number two, focus on prevention. And I'll be honest, I got to own that part of this is on me. I should have drank more water before I hiked up that mountain. And whether it's drinking more water or paying attention to your physical activity and your diet or taking your blood pressure medication or whatever it is, it's better to prevent problems than it is to have to deal with problems in the moment. And we need to think about our baseline health as individuals and also as communities, giving people more opportunities to make healthy choices. Number three, if you're in that situation, because sometimes no matter what you do, you're still going to end up in that situation, please, please don't be afraid to go in and get care, because, you know, all this becomes a moot point if you're not alive. And so I still feel like the right thing to do was to go in and initially get checked out. Once you're there, understand you have a right to ask, how much is this going to cost? And they have to make a reasonable attempt to help you understand how much it's going to cost. Many institutions now have a patient's bill of rights about transparency. And if you're asking that question throughout, then at least you have some visibility. And you also then can point back to, if that bill comes, hey, I asked the question because I was concerned about this cost, and you all didn't tell me how much this was going to cost. And so it gives you that to point back to on the back end. When that bill comes, know that you can continue to challenge the bill. So you should ask for an itemized bill if something seems not right. And know that when you challenge a bill, that there's multiple opportunities for that bill to be reduced, either through recognition of mistakes or through negotiation. And then finally, there are different services out there that you can reach out to that can help you in this negotiation process. I don't love the fact that we're stacking another industry on top of a broken system to help people navigate that broken system, but we are where we are. And so I want people to understand that you do have a number of options if you have that bill to be able to fight it.
It's a good reminder that there are other organizations, a lot of community-based organizations, and sometimes it even helps to call. I'll just put a plug in to your kind of local provider's office. Might not be your exact provider, but often the patient care navigators at the front desks of, like, my clinic, for example, we get this all the time, and we know groups we can direct people to help with just even understanding your bills. You and I speak with others about health literacy, and it's a very real problem that you can't really read even the paperwork they give you because it's, you know, written for someone with a certain education or assumptions around language.
I couldn't agree more.
Heck, I couldn't even understand my medical bill. It was 12 pages a very small print that I'm sitting there parsing through with a highlighter trying to figure out, okay, what did they charge me for this? And what does this code mean? So yeah, sometimes you do need an expert. And I love that. Asking your provider, asking the hospital. Sometimes even if everything is correct, there are groups out there, nonprofit groups and groups in your community that may help you with that medical bill.
So Jerome, you mentioned this, right, that the system is broken. And if we step back and we look at this from a really wide lens in the macro sense, there's a lot about our healthcare system that doesn't work, especially when we're thinking about how we pay for it. And I mean, like you said, the average American consumer, like, it's a struggle. When we look at other, I would say, developed nations, nations that are wealthy, they have these fortified public health systems, these systems that really look at healthcare for all. And here in the US, this has made some folks like Bernie Sanders push to expand public healthcare for all. Now, I know you disagree with this approach. Can you share a little bit about why?
Well, first of all, I completely agree with Bernie Sanders, and I've had conversations with him on this, that everyone deserves access to high quality, affordable healthcare. And I think it's important that we start the conversation there because that's common ground. Few people are going to argue against that. Then you start to ask yourself, okay, how do we get there? How do we get to a place where we're giving everyone high quality, affordable healthcare? And in some countries, it's through government provision of health insurance. And there are good things and there are bad things about that. I'm literally going to Canada in the next couple of days, and I can tell you that there are a lot of folks in Canada who are not happy about how long it takes them to get access to their healthcare system. So there's good things and bad things about the government provision of healthcare. Innovation. Much of the healthcare innovation that's going on our planet is happening in the United States, because of our market-based system that allows people to profit if they come up with an innovation that does things better or quicker or delivers access to more people.
To your point, Jerome, it is important when people have choices, right? And I think no one would disagree with that.
Exactly. And so here's what I have been doing. I've really been trying to accept that we are in a country where 20% of our GDP is healthcare, where our system is predicated on some things that if we were to build it from scratch, we wouldn't do it that way, but we've got to figure out how to optimize it. And so I've talked to businesses, and we saw this with the Affordable Care Act, but interestingly enough, in Indiana, when we used the Affordable Care Act funding to expand, and many conservative states didn't, we did it by making the business case. We went to employers and said, hey, healthcare is your number two expense, and people don't show up for work when they're sick. People don't show up for work when their kids are sick. And so it behooves you from an economic perspective as a business owner to make sure we have opportunities for people to get access to high quality, affordable healthcare. Making that business case that if you're going to keep this market-based system, let's make sure everyone has access to it. That's one thing we need to do, is continue to encourage businesses to understand the value of providing that high quality, affordable healthcare. But when I was Surgeon General, I put out a report called Community Health and Economic Prosperity that wasn't at all about healthcare. It was about health. What I just said may be lost on some people, but only about 20% of your overall health is determined by your access to healthcare. We spend a lot of our time and an inordinate amount of our time talking about healthcare, but only about 20% of your health is determined by healthcare. The other 80% is determined by things like paid time off if you're sick, transportation, housing, access to fresh fruits and vegetables, safe places to exercise. And if we can create healthy communities, and that's really what I'm trying to get businesses and politicians to understand, then we will have fewer people with diabetes, fewer people with cancer, fewer people with heart disease. And we won't need so much expensive health care on the back end. So focusing on prevention, I think, is also going to be key. And we can't focus on prevention if we don't create healthy communities. I could go on, but those are the things that really I'm focused on right now. And I'd rather have Mark Cuban or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk making the case for health than to have the Surgeon General of the United States, because Congress is going to listen when business owners lean in on this topic.
This is now the time when we try to close out, but with Jerome, it's hard to kind of close out because there's so much we want to talk about. Let me leave you with a couple of final questions to answer. So number one, there are some solutions out there. We don't need to be totally pessimistic. Mention any that you might be working on that you're excited about? And then for the love of all that is public health, can we continue to drink our milk?
Well, number one, there are solutions out there, but you can't solve a problem that you don't acknowledge exists. So I want to thank you all for shining a light on this issue. And I want everyone to understand that no matter who you are or where you sit, you will be impacted if we don't address some of these issues, but also you have levers, whether it's as an individual or as a business owner or as a voter, to actually help your voice be heard and to advocate for changes that are going to fix the broken parts of the system. Sometimes it's just sharing your story like we're doing today. And as I mentioned, we're not going to move forward until businesses step up and help us make that case for why we need to fix this healthcare system. Because far too often, public health and prevention is pitted against the business case. And I want people to understand, we saw during COVID that you're not going to be able to be economically viable as a society or as an individual if you're not healthy as a society or as an individual. Which leads to the final point that you ask, can we drink milk? And the quick context for that is, hey, we're looking at 2020 all over again in many ways with bird flu, H5N1. And you're having to weigh, okay, do we shut down the whole dairy industry out of an abundance of caution, while at the same time suffering economic harm and harm to people who rely on dairy products as part of their daily nutrition and sustenance? I'll tell you that I had milk this morning. You don't know what you don't know. We really need the administration to double down on their efforts to communicate and to share the data that they have with the public so that the public can be reassured. But between the pasteurization process, between individual and industry food and safety protocols, between the fact that most milk is pasteurized, 99% of all milk is pasteurized, and you shouldn't drink raw milk. And I may get in trouble for saying that in some quarters, but I just don't advise it as a public health physician that folks drink raw milk.
We would agree with you. Do not drink raw milk. We would agree.
And the digestive process breaks down many viruses. And it's important for listeners to know that as of the recording of this, no live virus has been found in milk or eggs, even though viral fragments have been found in some milk. I feel like the milk is safe to consume. It's low risk. And I feel like there's a much higher risk if everyone were to suddenly start avoiding dairy products because it's such a part of the American diet. And we know that when you look at WIC, when you look at SNAP, there are kids that would go hungry if we literally told them to stop drinking milk. So that's a great thing to close on because, again, it really shows you these trade-offs, these tough trade-offs that we have, whether it's trying to figure out how to pay for healthcare or whether it's trying to figure out what to do in a emerging outbreak and pandemic. It's why we need to have these conversations. It's why we need to realize there's not going to be one right answer. We need to have all parties at the table understand the problem and work together towards solutions that help the maximum number of people, harm the minimum number of people, and always have an eye to health equity and making sure we're not unduly harming marginalized populations.
That's a great note to end on. Dr. Jerome Adams is dad, doctor, and former Surgeon General of the United States. By the way, unanimously confirmed, not a small feat in this 21st century. His book, Crisis and Chaos, Lessons from the Front Lines of the War Against COVID-19, is out now, has a lot of great lessons in there for not just bird flu, but public health in general, and very accessible and approachable, no matter who you are. Jerome, thank you so much for joining myself and Maya.
Thank you both for having me today.
We reached out to the Mayo Clinic in Arizona that provided care to Surgeon General Jerome Adams for their take on the situation. The communications office provided us with this statement. Mayo Clinic is committed to providing high-quality, high-value care for all its patients and to ensuring that financial considerations are not an obstacle between patients and the care they need. Without patient authorization, Mayo Clinic's adherence to patient privacy laws prevents us from discussing specific patient circumstances or providing additional clarifying relevant facts. And that's our show this week. Well Now is produced by Vic Whitley Berry. Ben Richman is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio.
We'd love to hear from you. Email us at wellnow@slate.com. If you want to support this show, please consider becoming a Slate Plus member. You'll get to listen to this show ad-free, as well as hear bonus material from some of your other favorite Slate podcasts, like Slow Burn and Amicus. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday as we tackle another part of the wellness industry. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. Thanks for listening.